This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Mel King has died. The legendary politician, activist, and a beating heart of Boston passed away yesterday in his home. He was 94.
I'll never forget that my father said, no matter what you have, you always have enough to share.
That's King talking to GBH in 1983, recalling how his father fed a hungry man who had followed Mel home from school one day. King followed that moment with a lifetime of advocacy for racial justice, equity, and the city's neighborhoods. Since the news broke yesterday, leaders throughout the region have been reflecting on what Mel King meant to them. Tanisha Sullivan joins us now to reflect, too. She is president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP. Tanisha, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me this morning under unfortunate circumstances, but certainly appreciate the opportunity to really lift up the life and legacy of Mel King.
So let's do that. Let's lift up the life. Let's celebrate the life today, Tanisha. Where were you when you heard the news? Were you with friends and family? Were you with others who knew Mel King? Were you on your own?
I actually got the news late yesterday, and it was ironically in the midst of doing some planning, advocacy planning, which, the irony of that, of course, is that the life of Mel King really speaks to the importance of our continued work in our communities and on behalf of our communities to help ensure that, all people really do have the opportunity to benefit from the prosperity that exists in the city of Boston.
And how are you thinking about Mel King today? It's 12 hours later. The whole city is talking about it, reflecting. What's on your mind?
First, I want to just really lift up the deep commitment that Mel King had to the city of Boston, his enduring belief in the great potential of this city to really be a place where all people, regardless of their race, color, ethnicity, gender, could live, work, and thrive. And he dedicated his life to helping to ensure that that would be a reality for all of us. And, I am grateful for the work that he did, the doors that he opened. When we think about Mel King, oftentimes, folks remember his 83 mayoral campaign with Ray Flynn at the time. And, what I like to remember about that is certainly the viable campaign that he put on, but also the fact that his theme of this rainbow coalition really did transcend Boston and hit the national stage. The Reverend Jesse Jackson took note and really helped to carry that message across the country. So we're talking about a man whose work was certainly impactful here in Boston and across the Commonwealth, but really did have a national impact.
So we're talking with Tanisha Sullivan about Mel King. Let's talk about that life dedicated to Boston. Let me just, for listeners, born in 1928 in the South End, his mother from Guyana, his father from Barbados, lived his whole life in Boston except for when he was away for college. His activism became really prominent in the 1960s after the city bulldozed his neighborhood, calling it a slum, then Mayor John Haines did. That's part of what propelled him into activism, although in one of the obituaries I read for today, he famously said, at the time, I was alive 75 years and I've been an activist for 75 years. You talked about the mayoral campaign in 1983. First, he was elected in 73 to represent Suffolk County in the 9th District of the State House. After that loss, he remained a constant fixture of advocacy, social action. Tanisha, one of the things that struck me today was reviewing his life was like reviewing the history of Boston in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. He made part of our history.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about just Bostonians of that time, Black Bostonians of that time, it is important to note he was born in the South End, and the South End had a very vibrant, active Black community, through the 50s and the 60s, And Mel King was a part of that. He was someone who, you know, when he went off to college, he did attend a historically black college and university. And like many of the black students at that time, going to school during at the height of the civil rights movement, you know, part of what schools were helping to educate young people around and kind of that ecosystem was really nurturing was this sense of commitment to community, you know, having an understanding that the work that our lives and that our work should not just be centered on our own individual progress or success, but that as we continue to progress as individuals, that we are consistently thinking about our community and how we can bring what we're learning back into our community, how we can really help to seed growth and opportunities for other people in our community. And Mel King carried that forward. It was rooted and seeded in the South End community where he grew up. It was nurtured at Claflin. And certainly he put all of that into practice here in Boston as a community advocate, as an elected official, and as someone who just consistently challenged Boston to live up to her potential and to really deliver for all of us.
So, Tanisha, I'm going to bring his voice back to us one more time here. This is from my colleague Max Larkin's reporting this morning.
I'm not talking about that melting pot kind of thing, talking about integration at the seats of power and decision making. And without that, the rest of what we talk about is a sham.
And he's talking about, you know, the Rainbow Coalition, the type of equity that he was fighting for. In our last minute or so, Tanisha, who are the black leaders of today that you see carrying the Mel King spirit?
Listen, I cannot. The person who has been on my mind all day is Dr. Carolyn Crockett. You know, Carolyn is a Bostonian through and through. She's someone who she's a professor at MIT now. Many might remember she was the chief equity officer for the city of Boston. She's a brilliant scholar, academic, and advocate. She truly does embody the life and legacy of Mel King, and someone who I know will continue to carry forward that legacy. I am thinking about Darren Howell today, who is a leader in the labor movement. He's with 1199 SEIU, someone who is truly a student of Mel King and every day is putting into practice the work of Mel King. We are so fortunate that there are sons and daughters of Boston who today are carrying forward, carrying that light, carrying that mantle of Mel King. And Dr. Crockett and Darren Howell are two that I would just like to lift up today.
Tanisha Sullivan, I'm guessing there are others who would say you as well. I want to thank you for taking the time this morning. Tanisha Sullivan is president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, helping us reflect on the passing this week of Mel King at the age of 94. Tanisha, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn to education, specifically special education here in Massachusetts. After almost a decade of work, the state is overhauling the forms that educators use to get students special education services. Will these new efforts improve what's called the Individual Education Program, or IEP? And will they improve the often difficult experience families can have with them? WBUR education reporter Carrie Young has been following this story, joins us from the newsroom. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. This is an interesting story. There's a lot to get into, but it might be helpful to start by explaining the educational services for people who might not know. When students are determined to have a special need, they're entitled by law to receive special education services, right?
For the most part, yes. So in order to get an IEP, an individualized education program, you need to have first a documented disability. And then as a result of that disability, you must require, according to the state, a specially designed instruction or service to be able to access curriculum and also make progress on that curriculum. There's also something called a 504. But that has a wider range of conditions that qualify. It's not quite an IEP. we could go into details, but it's complicated,
almost,
I guess,
like
to tell you.
Almost like overlapping circles there, right?
Indeed, yes.
All right. So let's stay with the IEP. How many students have individual education programs now in the state?
Yeah, so there's about, the latest numbers I saw from the state, there's about 170,000 students across Massachusetts that have an IEP. And, you know, Massachusetts, I guess it's fair to say that that is a lot. Massachusetts, when I got here in 2018, I remember looking at the numbers and being struck that Massachusetts was about 37-ish percent higher than the national average when it comes to students who have an IEP.
Do you have a sense of why that is?
You know, that's a great question. I don't. You know, it's something that's been growing across the country, the number of students that have these. Also been growing in Massachusetts. So the answer behind that, I would imagine, is complicated.
So you've got roughly 170,000 students, which means lots of different kids, and everybody's kind of unique. How different are the IEPs? Are they pretty consistent across kids? Are they heavily tailored?
They are heavily tailored, I would say. So, you know, for example, you can have an IEP if you are hearing impaired or if you know, you have a vision impairment. And so, you know, those might just require, like, you know, if you're hearing impaired, someone who's there signing for you the curriculum in the classroom, a vision impairment, maybe you get special seating. So it can be something like that. But if you have a, if you're a person with autism, for example, then you, there are totally different accommodations, maybe therapies that you might be entitled to. So it's a wide range.
So as I understand it, Carrie, let's move now. And we're talking with WBUR education reporter Carrie Young about the new IEP or Individual Education Program forms, a 10-year rehaul, right?
Yeah, it took 10 years.
So my understanding is, Carrie, that these forms really drive what then is provided to students. So what was the impetus to make this change?
Well, first of all, I kind of want to address the elephant in the room that it's like, okay, this is a form. Why are we talking about a form, right? I remember pitching that, and that was the first question I got. And after I made some calls, it, you know, the more I learned that the form is kind of what drives the process
to
develop
these
IEPs. Yeah, and so in order to have a better process, one that addresses more of the needs, is more inclusive, state officials, along with advocates who had been pushing for this for a little while before the change officially had started, you know, decided that maybe we should update this. It's not a law change. It's not a policy change per se. It's just a way to better implement the law in a way that serves students and parents better.
Okay. As I learned about this story, I kind of didn't get it until I saw your photos, right, of what the old form looked like and what the new forms look like. And you've brought them in. We're going to talk about that. We're also tweeting the @RadioBoston Twitter feed. We'll have pictures of these forms so you can kind of follow along. You can see the difference on how this might change how families and schools work together just by this form.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so when you look at them, one of the first things, I mean, one of the basic things is one is in color and one is not.
Yeah.
That's a simple thing. But the
it's welcoming. It's more welcoming.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it definitely is. The other thing is you'll notice is in the old form, after student information, name, date of birth, that kind of thing, it starts by asking you to list out concerns that, you know, the student and the family and the educators want to work on. And that's the criticism against that was that it was very deficit focused.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts things off on a really kind of a negative tone. That's what students had told me, like that was really intimidating. Same with parents. Whereas the new form, the first question is, what is the student's vision? And what do you want to learn this year? Even just the language that they use. So they might still have student vision on both, but the new one describes, like, student vision. I want to learn this year.
I want.
Right. Or even post-secondary. That term is still included on both, but, you know, when it comes to post-secondary goals, the new form lists, you know, what are your goals after high school? After high school, I want to do this or do that. And so it makes it more accessible for students who are in these meetings, but also there's a growing number of students who have disabilities who are also English learners, as are their parents. And so, you know, it just makes it more accessible for everyone involved.
So let's use an illustration, because you got to know a young man who had gone through school with an IEP, an individual education program. Tell us a little bit about Evan.
Yeah. So Evan Gabovich is who I spoke to. He graduated high school about 9 years ago now, but he was very familiar with the process when the update process started, when he was first consulted. So he says he had mixed emotions about those IEP meetings, which happened yearly in school. He said in middle school, the way he described it was pretty bad. Here's a little excerpt from our interview of him describing that point in time.
In middle school, there was a lot more resistance, not just about my suggestions, but also on what my parents want, and that teachers and the administration wanted to impose what they thought I would need instead of other considerations. And that could be very difficult sometimes because it would lead to certain frustrations. It would lead to, unfortunately, certain deficits, such as in my reading comprehension and taking all these reading comprehension tests so that I get the services that I needed. It was not a particularly easy time in middle school.
Yeah, Evan said that, that just sort of reiterates how he said, it wasn't a great experience. By high school, he did tell me that they did get better, but there's some nuance there, too. And here's how he described that.
You know, it wasn't a matter of looking forward to them necessarily, but I think definitely in high school, I understood how important it was to be in charge of my own education and to understand that I do have a voice and I can, say certain concerns that I had for myself.
And so, knowing what it felt like to have more of a voice and also what it felt like to not. He said that was one of the many reasons he joined in on the effort to update the form and also advocate for the new form.
So as I understand it, Carrie, this is really about a form that centers the students and the parents, what they want, what their hopes are versus here are your deficits or our concerns as a school, so here's what we're going to give you. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say so. And, before the release, the new form is officially released on Friday. But before that happened, there were a couple school districts that were piloting the new form just to sort of test it out, see what worked, what didn't in the drafts. And they said the two school districts I talked to said it opened up just a different type of conversation. The air felt lighter almost, and it gave people a feeling like what they had to say was, valued and considered.
Does Evan think it's going to work, this new form? Does he think it's going to make things better?
So Evan, what were Evan's words? He told me that, he thinks that this is a good first step, that this was a huge update and one that needed to happen. And I'll let him finish the rest of this thought.
Well, the final result is a very good starting place. And I think that our group and many other stakeholders had worked incredibly hard to try and, update it, to try and get it to be where it needs to be, where many advocacy groups want it to be. But it's only the start, because what we will get to is when we have it, then we got to keep looking at where else we need to improve.
Yeah, the point he is making and that a lot of other people made was that there's a lot more to do when it comes to improving the experience in special education. And, this was a really good start, but we can't just stop here and say we're done kind of thing.
So do you have a sense from your reporting on this of some of the other big areas of improvement that might come next?
Well, one thing that Evan pointed out was he wanted to, focus on making sure that students who were from disadvantaged communities and schools that maybe not be as well resourced as the school district he went to, like in Lexington, that they get better access to the services that they need. And, I think there is still work on some of the language, the clinical language that is in these forms and the purpose that they serve in terms of, do we need this? Is this a little too deficit focused and that kind of thing?
So, Carrie, just briefly, it occurs to me, I can imagine there are people listening who are still saying, it's a form, right?
Right.
Why did it take 10 years?
There were a lot of stakeholders. There were dozens of stakeholders. There were a ton of, there was a form that went out to quite a few parents asking for their feedback. And so between the different drafts and reiterations, most advocates that I spoke to who were involved in this process were like, yes, it did take a while, the state included, when I asked them about this. They were like, yeah, it did take a while. But at the same time, we needed that to make sure that everyone's input was included and reflected in the new form.
And in a sentence or two, what are you going to watch now?
I think, you know, I want to see how, you know, what the experience is like in a broad sense. There were only a few districts that were testing this out. So now that every single district is going to be using it in 2024, what's that going to be like?
We will check back in with you on that. Carrie Young is a senior education reporter here at WBUR. It is always great to have you on. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There is more ahead. I'm Tisiana Deering, and you are listening to Radio Boston. A girl, her loom, and what happens when confidence replaces fear? That is the story of Arachne. Well, at least as told by author Rebecca Caprera and her new book, Spin. But that is not the story of Arachne that most people know. Normally, she's a villain, one who had the temerity to take on a god. But not for Rebecca Caprera. She tells a new tale of the young weaver, one meant for a new young adult audience. Rebecca Caprera joins us now in Studio 2. Welcome back, Rebecca.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I just adored this book. And I just want you to start by telling us, if you could pick one word to describe this story, what would it be?
Oh, that's a good one. Feminist.
Why?
Maybe a second word would be brazen.
Why did you want to do that?
Yes. So when I rediscovered Ovid's version of the myth of Arachne, and I reread that story, I had chills because this young woman struck me, and her story struck me as being so relevant and so timely. This was, you know, in the midst of our current political landscape, in the midst of the Me Too movement, in terms of conversations about women's rights and bodily autonomy. And there was just so much about her being bold enough and strong enough to speak truth to power that resonated, even though it's an ancient tale. But the issue I took with all the iterations that I'd seen of her story was with the ending. And I felt like she deserved better. And I wanted to give her that opportunity to kind of speak her truth and tell her story as I envisioned it.
So tell us just very briefly the original version of the story.
Yeah, so Arachne is a young woman who is a weaver, a very accomplished weaver. And she, so she's often, like you said, framed as villainess or monster. And this story really wanted to unravel those portrayals of her, as well as illuminating some of the distorted portrayals of other women throughout classical mythology. And in the original, there is this showdown between Arachne and Athena, who is the goddess of weaving. And Athena demands that Arachne repent for her pride and her insolence.
Her pride in her talent.
Right, right, which is well earned, right? This is something that was not, there was no divine intervention. This is a skill that she learned. It was handed down by her mother and her grandmother, this craft of weaving. And she worked incredibly hard to achieve this skill. And so she is proud of it. And she refuses to back down. And so there is this confrontation. And in other versions of the story, you know, there is a transformation, right? Even in my version, there is this shocking transformation, but a spider, yeah. Spoiler alert.
We get to do that on
yes,
the show.
Yes. but I wanted her to have more agency,
yeah.
Without giving away too much of this story. I wanted her to have more agency. I wanted the reader to understand what might make a young woman have that kind of composure and strength, you know, to stand up to a literal god. I mean, she's a young woman from very humble upbringing. So what did it take to get her there? And what was that backstory like?
And I want to point out, we were sort of joking about the spoiler alert, but in two ways, it's not a spoiler alert. One, because Arachne and Arachnid, it's not hard to
right.
connect the
yes.
dots. And two, because it's not, as you say, it's not what happens to her in the end. It's the way it happens. That is everything. In this story.
Yes. And what she does with it after.
That's right. And when you talk about, you know, I asked you for one word, the first thing you said was feminist,
mm-hmm.
right? And when you talk about the fact that she is proud of what she can do and the gods are mad at her
right.
for being proud of what she can do, that really is striking. One of the themes that comes forward in the story over and over again, Rebecca, for example, when she asks for what her tapestries are worth in
mm-hmm.
the marketplace and people are shocked when she asks what her work is worth.
Right.
It is this idea that over history, women and women workers have been expected to expect less.
Yes, absolutely. There's that piece of it. I think even this idea of female pride and female rage, these were things that were really interesting to me. You know, why shouldn't she be proud of what she has accomplished? You know, why are we focusing all these narratives centering the heroic male counterparts in these stories and not celebrating the women who are perhaps equally talented in a different way? So
I want to step to the side for a second. We're going to come back to the story itself in a minute, but I want to step to the side because I've read other books by you. Worst Case Colin, I absolutely adored. You decided to write this one in verse.
Yes.
And I don't know if scared me is right, but I'm like, can I do this whole
book in
verse?
Poetry's not scary, but I understand why people feel that way.
And I'm going to give just a tiny bit of an example. This is from when Arachne is watching her mother weave before she even knows how. Row by row, an image emerges in the cloth, an emerald-leafed tree with a dark-haired girl swinging from its branches. Is that me? I ask, gazing at her creation with wonder. There is an ancientness to the form you've chosen that makes me feel like you're taking me back to that Greek story and then bringing it to me today.
I love that you picked up on that. Verse is obviously a format I feel comfortable with. I love poetry. I've written other books in this format, but this one is slightly different. It's free verse. And I felt like I loved the musical quality of it, which you're kind of mentioning, that lyricism that comes from the form. But I also wanted it to be a nod to the epic poetry of the past, right? The books and the sources that inspired me, you know, Homer, Sappho, Ovid, of course. And so it's sort of a fresh take on those poetic forms.
And it's interesting that you're doing that for young adults. Are young adults afraid of verse? I mean, in the YA fiction world, my understanding is verse is beginning to kind of place a little bit of center stage.
I hope so. I mean, I am a huge fan. I think Jason Reynolds, Elizabeth Acevedo, Kip Wilson, there are so many, Margarita Engel. I could go on and on about the sort of YA poets who are writing verse novels for young adults and middle grade readers. And I think it's very accessible. I think verse is beautiful for so many reasons, but it's not overwhelming on the page. Sometimes prose can feel heavy. I think there's so much breathing room and white space in a verse novel, and it allows me as an author to explore what might be deemed kind of heavier subject matter, because there's a lot of space for the reader to sort of sit with these ideas and kind of digest them and take them at their own pace.
We're talking with local author Rebecca Caprera about her newest book, Spin, which uses a verse form to retell, with a very modern take, the story of Arachne. And for those of you who are now thinking, wait, I didn't write down those author names. What were they? Don't worry, don't forget. You can find this conversation later at radioboston.org, and you will be able to hear all the authors that Rebecca was just recommending. I want to come back to the story now, because one of the things that I found myself thinking was, you must have studied weaving, because when Arachne weaves her first tapestry, and even more so when she weaves her last tapestry, your descriptions of how the colors come together and the types of thread and the dye, once again, something I didn't even think I cared about, and I can see it, I can smell it, I can feel it and touch it. Do you weave?
So this is sort of interesting. I love that you connected to those scenes, I have to say, because when I pitched this novel and I'm like, yeah, the climax is a weaving competition, people look at me like, okay, that's about as exciting as watching paint dry. But it is. It's so exciting. And even Ovid's version, there's like these scintillating details and they use the vocabulary of war. And but to go to your question, I have a background in fiber arts. Many, many years ago, when I was in high school, I was a historical interpreter at Sturbridge Village in Massachusetts, where I dressed and acted like a girl from the 1830s, which is obviously a different time period. So I learned to weave on a different sort of loom than Arachne would have. But I was carding wool and dyeing, you know, fabric and spinning.
So you do know.
I do know. It's been a long time, but I think that interest was sort of seated deep within me. And then it was fun to revisit this. And I also, what was fascinating in the research portion of this project was looking into the sort of the ancient dye methods. Her father, Arachne's father, is a dyer of purple. And the process to get that color is fascinating. And, you know, there's a line in the book that says violet begins with violence. And it's really interesting.
So the other thing that strikes me about this, and this is hard content for the next minute or so, I want our listeners to know, the power of her loom is to tell the truth.
Yes.
To tell stories of rape, to tell stories of sexual assault and victimization that have been either swept under or retold as if everything's okay.
Yes. Yes. And I think for this character, I mean, she's illiterate, right? She can't read or write, but she finds, not only does she seek solace in the loom, she has a very hard upbringing, but she finds her strength and her voice through the craft of weaving. And in this confrontation with Athena, I think she's sold short in some other versions. You know, it's not just about her ego. Yes, she's proud, and I think she deserves to be proud, but she recognizes that this moment is an opportunity to speak out. The entire city has gathered to watch a mortal essentially duel with a goddess. And she realizes that this is her moment to kind of speak truth to power, to illuminate some of the injustices that have been inflicted upon her, upon the people that she loves, and upon the women and nymphs and goddesses that appear in these stories that have been handed down to her by her mother, and, you know, that she's heard the bards sing in the square. And so she does. She uses this. You know, I thought a lot about the Kavanaugh hearings when I was writing this. It channeled a lot of
Supreme Court nominee.
Yes, and Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, and thinking about that composure and taking that moment and speaking from a place of pain and trauma, and just the fortitude and respect I have for people who are able to do that, including Arachne.
Just very briefly.
Yes.
Do you wish somebody had told you this story this way when you were a young adult?
Definitely. Definitely. And, you know, I'm only one voice of many. There's so many wonderful authors writing these retellings. That would be a whole nother segment.
Which maybe at some point we should do.
Yes.
All right. Local author Rebecca Caprera. The new book is Spin. It is out now. It is worth a look. Rebecca, thank you so much
for the book. Thank you so much.
And for being here.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.